I can't imagine a harder challenge, actually, than following a real inspirational star like Lisa Nelson is, I think, you know, single-handedly with the downloads that have taken place over the last 12 or 18 months. And I think there have been a lot more since we profiled it in our report. You must have saved the sector hundreds of thousands of pounds already. I mean, a staggering achievement. And secondly, being almost all that stands between you and a bank holiday, but I'll do my best to be quick. You know, I think one of the central issues I hear is if we're convinced by some of these arguments, and I hope I'll present more in the next few minutes, you know, how do we deal with it and how do we think about it? And in this, as in many other areas, you know, we've probably tended to have an attitude that the green stuff's over here, and we do a few things, we may power down, etc. And then that's it, job done. And there's a lot of other stuff which is quite expensive, so we won't bother doing it. So very often the whole debate is configured in terms of how much is it going to cost or how difficult is it going to be to do these things. The central message, I think, of a lot of the kind of regulations that are coming through and a lot of the arguments that are coming through and the reality of the world we're getting to in the future is that we can no longer operate in that kind of way, that we've got to internalise a lot of this stuff in our processes, be it in IT or everywhere else. So as that river of activity flows along, the green stuff just can't be over there at the margins. Now, I say that because one of the projects I've run for the last 10 years or so, 8 years or so, it's called HEPI, that some of you may know, financed by the funding councils, and done a lot of stuff in a lot of different areas in the sector. And I look around, there's a number of people who've been to our activities, as one might expect, I suppose, if we've had 6,000 people through. And quite a lot of material on there that you may find of interest, but one thing that it does give us is a reasonably good kind of overview, I think, of different areas in the sector. And one of the big messages we tried to get through in our SUSTIT report and project is that if you look around at the moment and say, where is the low-hanging fruit? Where's the stuff that can produce relatively quick paybacks in the sector? Compared, let's say, to the kind of things that are being talked about when we talk about new buildings or refurbishments, where we're often arguing about 4 or 5 year paybacks. In IT, a lot of it is a lot less than that in reality. In some cases, if you can introduce power down relatively easily using Lisa's software, you know, you're talking a matter of months in terms of payback. So this is where the low-hanging fruit is in IT. And for that reason, if no other, there is going to be a lot more attention, I think, to the kind of topics we're seeing at the moment. Just a bit of background, we also have a big project at the moment on labs, and one of the big issues actually in labs is the whole way that a lot of research is migrating into what's called in silico, modelling of reactions, experimentation, etc. on computers. So a big issue in labs is the growing IT dependency. And someone mentioned earlier Bream Higher Education, or Bream. As it happens, we are the project managers for that as well. And I can tell you there is going to be a green IT credit in the new Bream Higher Education, which hopefully will be of benefit. Anyway, just briefly to SUSTIT, people have been kind enough to mention some of this stuff during the day, but there is quite a lot of material on the site that I hope might be of interest to you. A couple of things I'll talk about, but about 20-25 case studies, technical papers, and actually about 20-25 presentations from past events, most of which I think are still of interest. One of those tools, the kind of footprinting tool, we developed with the University of Sheffield, and particularly someone there called Chris Cartledge, who again is one of the kind of unsung heroes of green IT over the last few years in our sector. And Chris, amongst other things, just went around counting servers and measuring computer consumption for us at Sheffield. And these were the figures that he actually came up with for Sheffield itself. Most of the assumptions behind these are kind of embedded in the SUSTIT tool that we developed. So although the tool itself is not rocket science, it's just basically an inventory that you put your computers in, it makes some assumptions about idle time, full power, etc., and gives you some results. The assumptions behind it, the default assumptions you can use, are actually all based on measured data, primarily from the University of Sheffield, and that's one of its strengths. Anyway, you can see that Chris's work resulted in these figures from Sheffield, and they're probably underestimates because, you know, as I've said, in labs, for example, there's a lot of microprocessors and things like that embedded in scientific equipment these days, which we weren't counting. We weren't counting the Janet infrastructure, all of those kinds of things. So, excluding those areas, you know, we're still saying it's 18% of the electricity, 15% of carbon. And more to the point, perhaps, in today's cash-short times, £1 million plus the electricity bill. And that has certainly interested a number of senior managers in the institution. Now, the tool has now been used by a lot of people. We're collating the results, and you know, broadly, the figures are coming out the same. So one of the really interesting points, I think, appropriate this morning's discussion is, you know, what's the overall very crude balance between desktop and data centre in terms of balance of use? Well, the figures from most of the institutions that are using the tool are actually suggesting that it's the desktop. You see here at Sheffield, 47% desktop. And there's a range of 40 to 50% coming out from the others, including the FE colleges like Norwich, where John used the tool. So it actually suggests, you know, that what we're talking about today is a really big priority area and really worth doing something about. Now, the ratio may be different somewhere like Oxford, of course, with a lot more high-end scientific computing, but that's certainly what's coming out of our findings. Now, for time, I'll just whiz quickly on a little bit. But so what we did, really, was take that Sheffield data and just make some very crude assumptions and scaled it up to the rest of the sector to get a ballpark estimate of where we are. And these are the figures that actually came out. And again, the really interesting figure, perhaps, is the £60 million, because I think going forward, I'll mention in a minute something about the regulations, about the carbon reduction commitment, and you know, that's going to be an important driver. But in the world we're now in, with the credit crunch, where universities are looking at how they can save millions of pounds as a result of the Treasury squeeze, it's definitely going to be the cost savings that are going to sell most of this stuff internally. And the reality is, when you look at the numbers, there are indeed big cost savings to be had. And very similar figures for FE as well. We did the same exercise for FE, and it's a pretty similar figure that actually comes out. And I mean, just as a kind of backdrop here, you know, people saying, does it matter? Well, based on measured data at the from the Sheffield fleet of computers, this is what we actually calculated. You know, this is the range we're talking about. Get a really low-powered computer, apply power management as much as you possibly can. You're talking about £60 a year, £61 a year as running costs. Conversely, do everything we're talking about today, and I'll mention a bit more about the low energy procurement, and you're cutting it right down to £3. Now, as we also begin to extend refresh cycles, which was another of our recommendations in the report, then of course these operational savings become even greater, and the ratio of capital spend to operating spend also changes enormously. And you know, these are the basic financial realities of what we're talking about. I think I'll skip one or two, but just to come back to the point about the impacts here, you know, of those figures, roughly a million PCs and servers in our sector, given the electricity mix we have, those apparently lightweight virtual devices that, you know, you have in front of you and are working away on, actually have a big coal-fired power station attached to them. So you're really working effectively with 19th century steam-powered technology. In terms of environmental impacts, and that's why we have to change things, of course. Now, this slide is, in a way, is meant to terrify by the fact it's hard to read and very dense, because this is a summary of the Idiot's Guide to Regulation, which we produced recently at the request of all the directors of the states. And it's basically kind of one page for each of these different schemes or activities you see up here. And this is basically trying to summarise all the different regulatory initiatives, all the voluntary schemes which have an impact on the sector, relevant to carbon, which a university in particular is facing today. And you can see there's about kind of 18 on there. Some of those boxes actually summarise a number of underlying ones. And there's really a huge amount of stuff kind of coming through. Now, one of those we've heard about is the carbon reduction commitment, and you know, that will have some kind of impact if one is honest, one has to say it's an open question as to quite what impact it will actually have. You know, many of us remember similar debates around the emission trading scheme, for example, when that came in, and it hasn't had quite the impact we imagined at the time. But in a way, that doesn't really kind of matter, because, you know, if one fails, as it were, one of these instruments fails, there's a whole bunch of other stuff coming through. Because they have to come through, because we are committed to drive down carbon emissions by 80% as a country and as a member of the European Union. So at the moment, there's a lot of policy experimentation going on as to what will work, what won't work, different devices coming through. So there are many, many other things. You know, for example, there's an interesting one here, inspection of cooling systems, which is coming with the new building regulations, etc. Now, that's one, I think, if that turns out to be reasonably successful, as I think it will, then we can expect a mandatory inspection regime on the efficiency, the sizing of a wide range of equipment, I think, including, for example, power supply in data centres. And I think we probably will have that within a few years' time. And so on and so forth. I could go on, but I won't. But there's really a whole lot of regulation coming through. And that's obviously, in the main, one of the sticks, although there can be some financial advantage, as we heard, if you do well in things like the CRC. We also have energy costs, and although they've dipped a little bit recently, I think no one, with electricity in particular, expects that there's going to be anything less than a further doubling of the price of electricity, because we've got to replenish the grid, we've got to put in more renewable energy, etc., etc. And the stakeholders are increasingly vociferous. Again, HEFSI has a consultation this summer about how it will implement the 80% target within the sector, carbon target within the sector. Probably that will result in emissions targets for individual universities, and probably at some point that will result in funding hits if universities don't actually make those targets within a 5-10 year time frame. And when the university looks at how it can see those targets, as I say, it will be looking firmly, I think, down at IT as a major area. But I don't want to be all negative. I think there are lots of carrots here. Obviously, if you save energy, financial benefits. We heard about some of the space benefits from John earlier, and those are very, very important. And there are also big, I think, teaching and research opportunities here. We have the IT industry, very broadly defined, or this digital industry, is estimated to be about 10% of global GDP. That's an awful lot of employees. It's an awful lot of research pounds or dollars, much of which will be directed universities' way in the next few years, and as many of the graduates coming out will be going into those sectors, and by and large those sectors are wanting people cognizant with the kind of issues we're talking about. So there's lots of opportunities for courses, for research, etc. In fact, we have someone in the room from Middlesex University, I think, who's launching one of the first green IT MSCs this summer. And just you know, thinking of the research side of things, obviously big here at Oxford. A new scheme just launched in the States, a new research project called Greenlight at San Diego, part of the University of California. This is a computing resource for scientific computing, etc. But at the same time, it's going to be a real life testbed around green IT research. And in particular, one of their tasks is to get a much finer understanding of, you know, the energy impacts of computing activities, individual bits of software, processing, etc., and what that actually is. So it's an example, I think, of how research money is starting to become available in this area. But Howard asked me to sort of focus a little bit on a couple of topics that weren't being covered in the early presentations, and one of those is procurement, and behind that, you know, the issue of life cycle impacts of IT. And obviously it does have a very, very big impact in its manufacture, in its disposal, etc. And really, I suppose there are three fundamental questions when we think about that. You know, what is the balance of impacts between use, between production, assembly, for example, and then the materials themselves, the production of silicon, all those kinds of things. And that leads on really to the next question. You know, when you think of the complexity of IT, you've got Hewlett-Packard, for example, as a tier one supplier. It's got its tier two suppliers, disk drives, the assembled components. You know, each of those is typically made from subcomponents coming from a tier three supplier. Some of the bits of those may come from a tier four supplier, then they buy their silicon from a tier five supplier. And you're pretty soon getting down to tier six, tier seven suppliers. And it's a very real question, I think, as to can we ever get accurate information about some of these things, given the complexity of that supply chain. And I think it's clearly very, very difficult. But equally, you can see just from the figures that Hewlett-Packard, and you know, pat on the back to them for trying it, has done, just with regard to its tier one suppliers, and you can see they're three times bigger in terms of carbon impacts than HP itself, and that will be multiplied through the chain. So it's certainly an important issue, and of course the practical question is how can we influence that, particularly as universities? Well, just a little bit of background. We spent, in fact, at Ranglisa yesterday, actually, to get to do a bit of research. The project manager for SustIT, who's been invaluable in many of the outputs, she actually literally screamed when I asked her to just check up on the latest position of the Eric Williams EU findings debate, because we spent so many hours trying to actually grapple and understand. But one of the difficulties here is, if you say, well, where are the energy impacts in the chain? You know, they're mainly in production, mainly in use. We have two reputable studies reaching exactly opposite conclusions. You know, the best known one is the Williams UN study, which was quoted a number of times at this conference last year, for example. You know, and that says 80% of the lifetime energy use associated with a computer is in production. Whereas very, very detailed studies done for the EU as part of the Energy Use and Products Directive, reach exactly the opposite conclusion. 80%, they say, is actually in use. So in one of our technical papers on personal computing, you can see our disaggregation of the studies and why they seem to be reaching such different conclusions. And you know, some of it is quite legitimate. You know, as we drive down through power down, things like that, the consumption of PCs, then obviously the balance will shift, and the PC component will be a bit less, the use component will be a bit less as a percentage. So there are lots of legitimate reasons, as well as others. Anyway, you know, our working kind of assumption, really, that we derived from these studies was that actually for non-domestic computers at UK universities, you know, a reasonable working assumption on energy is 50-50. And therefore, it does make a lot of sense to put a lot of effort on the use of electricity in computers. We're not ignoring the fundamental problems if we devote a lot of our time to that. But there is no doubt that if we look at the overall impacts, they're very much stacked on down the production stage. You know, if you think of gold, for example, which is quite an important component of computers in terms of environmental impact, you know, how many tons of rock do we have to mill? And we, you know, literally expend huge amounts of energy grinding down rock to create a gram of gold. 2.5 tons. How many hazardous chemicals, you know, are there in a typical PC production chain, or at least there were a couple of years ago, according to Silicon Valley Toxic Coalition? Over 1,000. How many elements of the periodic table are present in the production chain of a PC? Over 60. So, again, you know, there's a very big footprint attached to many of these kind of things that we have to pay account to take account of. How do we do it? Well, there's no doubt the procurement is rising in the agenda. One of the things on that diagram I showed a bit earlier was quick wins, and that's a sort of government-mandated procurement program in a lot of areas that's trying to encourage best practice procurement and starting to devote more attention to energy. And actually will be an important, HEFSI has said, for example, that it will be the main way it discharges its obligations under this Energy Use and Products Directive, which requires public sector bodies to pay more attention to energy use and products. We started to get it in national agreements now, so some of the new PC agreements, for example, negotiated by the South England, London purchasing bodies, starting to put individual things in. And we are starting to get better tools. We heard about Energy Star 5, and that's being launched probably in July. And actually, Energy Star is now an EU-US collaboration, so it's had a lot of EU input to it. And a really important thing in procurement, I think, is that you are checking all your contracts and things like that. Do you specify an Energy Star 5? Because it is a big improvement on Energy Star 4. It will make a big difference. And we heard about APEAT. And APEAT is where Energy Star was 4 or 5 years ago, i.e. it's a US standard and not really applicable in Europe, and very, very few European machines, for example, are actually accredited to it. So it's actually quite difficult, for example, to use APEAT under EU purchasing legislation because you may be discriminating against European vendors. But a UK version, possibly an EU version as well, is actually being developed. So we will have a UK APEAT by probably in about 12 months' time, which will again will make life very, very much easier. It's not perfect, but solutions are starting to come through the procurement side, so watch that space very carefully. But I just wanted to kind of end with just a little bit on kind of data centres. You know, although, as we heard, desktops probably are a bit larger, nonetheless, data centres are obviously quite significant. And really, there are many exciting things equivalent to what we've heard on the PC side happening with data centres. Some people in the room know it because they've got JISC projects on this topic from East Anglia and Hertfordshire and Bolton. And there's really an awful lot that can be done. You know, one can look, for example, at the actual kind of computing activities, and people are obviously starting to move towards virtualization and implement it quite effectively, and a bunch of other stuff. There's a lot that can be done on the kind of cooling side. And one of the real big breakthroughs that's happened in the last few months is the new ASHRAE standards. It's US standard, but because a lot of computers are out of the US, it tends to be used internationally, which has relaxed the temperature and humidity bands that servers can operate within. And basically, obviously, a higher temperature band means less need for cooling. That plus free cooling means, I think, that one can envisage a data centre today which actually, in practice, has no operational cooling, no mechanical cooling at all. It would probably need some as a backup facility just in case, but people are approaching that goal. And then you've got the whole UPS side. You know, a couple of years ago we quoted some figures in our report, the average was around 78% in the States, but it's now relatively easy to get 90% plus in that area. And then we have the whole issue really of how the energy is provided to data centres, you know, particularly the idea of kind of migrating to more favourable locations, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But one of the issues here really with this, and it does come out I think in a lot of areas we highlighted in our report, is the need for greater interaction between estates and IT in this area and also in some other areas. And actually, again, commendations to Bolton here today, because I see they've actually brought a big team from both estates and IT, which I think is really fantastic. But just a couple of examples show what could be, you know, can be done, and obviously Oxford's starting to do that, or perhaps already doing the same in terms of some of its facilities. But a couple of case studies we had, I think probably last year, Cardiff seemed to be pretty much the state of the art. And in particular, this figure here is really important. You know, this is the percentage of the server electricity load that's actually taken up by useless, in functional terms, cooling and power supply. And they've got that down to about 30%, which is pretty good. The average is probably 60-70%. Similarly at Edinburgh, the craze they have up there, a lot of effort paid to using free cooling, which of course you can do in Edinburgh fairly easily. And again, got that overhead right down. So many success stories within the sector that we can actually be very, very proud of. But just kind of reaching a conclusion, we shouldn't be too negative about this, because this field, because this report here called Smart 2020 by McKinsey's, what better name is there than that to have on your report, and Geo Groups, you know, basically was coming up with these kind of figures as to the impact that ICT could have on reducing carbon emissions through its application. Also, of course, a lot of social benefits as well. And say, moreover, that the kind of benefits it envisaged, the big numbers as you can see there, were considerably greater than the energy used, you know, within the IT itself delivering those applications. And essentially what they were talking about was smart grid, you know, much more intelligent grids that in turn interact with smart buildings. So they're telling the buildings about the cost of power supply, carbon emissions levels, etc. And really a fully optimised system as a result of that. And of course the smart buildings are themselves then influencing the internal use. And finally, new ways of working, teleworking as we might call it, conferencing, etc. So really suggesting that ICT, as long as we drive down, bear down on some of these aspects of production we're talking about really can be part of the solution rather than the problem. Again, just another example, just to show that, HE is taking some interesting initiatives in this area. On that smart buildings front, this is someone we got over for one of our workshops. You can see the presentation on the website from it. This is the reference site globally for Cisco, for example, in terms of what they see as next generation facilities, which has a very high level of integration of different building services. At the moment, they tend to be very often on different platforms, can't talk to each other, certainly can't optimise to each other. So really trying to run everything through a common internet protocol backbone. And incidentally, one of the side effects of this is actually combined with moves to virtualisation and outsourcing is a considerable downsizing of IT in estates to the point they actually emerge into the same department. And they reckon they get by with about half the staff of a conventional university, and create a lot of energy benefits as well. So just finally, just in terms of, say, the future, because this field is moving very rapidly. A lot of the stuff we talked about in our report, 12 months ago, starting to be done, for example. In the near term, we have here Rob Bristow, if you'd like to put your hand up, Rob, from JISC, who is the JISC Green IT Manager, and I'm assisting Rob at the moment in actually developing a green IT programme at JISC with a funding stream approved. And a couple of things we have coming up is a workshop in the autumn, hopefully, around research and innovation agendas in this field, bringing industry together with academic researchers and others, and some specific initiatives which might well include procurement. But, if we project out and say, OK, we're here today, where are we going? I think one of the big issues that's obviously looming is there going to be a green cloud? If the cloud is going to be as important as people are saying, and it seems that it probably is, what really are the kind of implications of that? Well, one of the implications is it's clearly migrating a lot of activity from desktops, from local uses, into data centres, so it makes the whole issue of green data centres even more important. And I think in essence, it's a very simple answer. Cloud computing is going to be green and beneficial if the data centres themselves are ultra-green. And in practice, that really means zero carbon. And in the world we're entering, I think, in the cloud, through the use of things like virtualisation, we've almost, of course, completely cut the connection between a computing activity and the physical location of the server. So Philip mentioned this morning, maybe we can move some servers out of buildings into a central thing, but why stop there in today's world? Why not move it further? And in particular, why not put our data centres in Scotland, in the north of England, right next to the wind turbines, taking advantage of the free cooling, and actually migrate then over the internet, etc., the particular applications to them. And I think that's the vision that's actually starting to emerge, that IT may not need to be a follower in this field. It could actually be one of the real battering rams towards a zero carbon world, that you could envisage an infrastructure which is pretty much zero carbon if we really have the will to achieve it, particularly if that is then coupled with much lower impact personal devices, as we're starting to get, and particularly if it's coupled with the transformed ways of working that are possible in that kind of world. So I wanted to end on an optimistic note, and it's definitely, I think, part of the solution in the long term rather than the problem.